first in our Bill of Rights is the freedom to hear uncensored ideas and opinions, to think your own thoughts, and to say what's on your mind. We couldn't have liberty without it. Now, more than ever, it's good to spout off, to listen, debate, and participate. Here's your host of Spouting Off, commentator, columnist, and all-around rabble-rouser, Karen Cataline.
Well, good afternoon, Nashua, New Hampshire. It's good to spout off. Yes, it is. It's Thursday, and it's St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, which always March 17th is St. Patrick's Day. It's a happy holiday. If you were listening to the news, people go out. They may drink a little too much. They wear green or they get pinched. At least I remember that in school. And I didn't go to a particularly Catholic or religious school. I went to public school. But that was the day when everybody got to pinch you if you didn't wear green. And I'm not quite sure what all of the traditions are of St. Patrick's Day. But for many people, it is a day to play hooky. I remember playing hooky from grad school when I was going to grad school in New York, so I could watch the St. Patrick's Day parade come down Fifth Avenue in New York City. And it was a very good thing because I skipped a very boring class that day. And it was spring and I was about to graduate and, you know, I didn't used to do things like that. And I said, you know what? I'm taking the day off. What is so interesting to me this St. Patrick's Day is that it coincides with a Jewish holiday that we're celebrating today. As a matter of fact, after I'm done with this show, I'm going to go off and celebrate it with a whole bunch of Jews, and it's called Purim. Purim is the day we celebrate the story of Esther in the Bible. Many Christians read the story of Esther, and we read the book of Esther every year. Now, you may know I'm not particularly super observant, but I am studying. And ironically, the teacher that I'm studying with, and I'm doing a lot of different kinds of classes, happened to call me or text me today and say, can we do it? And she wanted to change the date. Anyway, just at the moment's notice, we're going to have her to enlighten us further about the holiday of Purim and what Jews and non-Jews can learn from it. Because we know we have a very religiously pluralistic audience. It isn't just for Jews. But since we share that book, the book of Esther, I thought I would invite her. Well, you want to come in today and talk about it. I have some remarks about Purim because it was a holiday that I never thought much of. I used to think it was kind of a minor holiday. And of course, most Jewish holidays are, they tried to kill us. They didn't. Let's eat. And it was a day to dress up in costumes. It seemed like Jewish Halloween, but it isn't. And we wear masks, like a big masquerade party. And we go to carnivals and something somewhat controversial. It's the day when rabbis, the one day a year when rabbis actually drink a little more. Jews notoriously, at least our religion, we don't prohibit alcohol or wine, but Jews notoriously are more into food than into liquor. But on Purim, rabbis drink just a little more than usual, and it's actually, there's a reason for that. We might get into that as well. But here's the point about Purim itself. There are things that I learned as an adult that made me start to love Purim and certainly apply it to what is going on. And that is it. This. The story of Purim is about Esther and trying to save her people, the Jewish people, from extinction. That we have many of those stories in Judaism because Haman, the bad guy, who is thought to be a descendant of the Amalekites. Many people think Hitler was a descendant of Haman, but that's another story for another day, and I'm not qualified to tell it. everything in the story of Purim is not as it appears to be. God is never mentioned in the story of Purim, and yet it is understood that the hand of God is everywhere in the story of Purim. And just like in a Hollywood movie, just when you think the Jews are done for because Haman, the bad guy, built a gallows to hang all the Jewish people, kill them, murder them, destroy them, he ends up getting hoisted by his own gallows, or hoisted by his own petard, and ends up being hung on the gallows that was meant for Mordechai, the cousin, I believe, of Esther. I'm going quickly through it because another one of the lessons of Purim for all of us is that things are upside down. Things are totally backwards, upside down than what normally appear to be true. Black is white, up is down, right is left, pink is blue. You know, everything seems a little off. And in fact, I have been using for some time now the analogy that every day is Purim in America lately, because that's kind of how it feels to me. We're living in a time, just as an example, where America is siding with Cuba and the communist Chinese. Did you ever think you'd live to see a day like that, when they would ignore freedom lovers who are protesting their own communist government in Cuba, and America that has been against the communization of Cuba for 70 plus years is now saying nothing and basically siding with communist Cuba? Did you ever think you'd hear or see a day when we shut down our own oil production and started begging for oil from Venezuela and Iran? More authoritarian, fascistic, totalitarian regimes. Venezuela didn't take long for them to suddenly become communist. Now we're begging for oil from Venezuela, but we don't like Russia. Criminals are victims. Law-abiding citizens are criminals. That's what they're trying to put out. Leftists hate Russia, and they're less communist than they ever used to be. Disney employees are being arrested for child sex trafficking instead of taking care of little kids that love to go to Disney. And while Walt Disney had a lot of interesting and twisted personality traits, number one, he was kind of a Jew hater, I have heard. He's probably rolling over in his grave because Disney has gone woke. It's a small world after all. Feminists are okay with destroying women's sports now. I mean, they fought and fought and fought for women's sports, but now leftist feminism and intersectionality requires that they think it's okay for men masquerading as women. Everybody's masquerading as something today, except that the politicians and the bureaucrats' masks are off now. Feminists are now cheering that women's sports are being totally destroyed in the Olympics and elsewhere. I have a whole bunch more. Leftist liberals and the ACLU are burning and banning books and toys like Mr. Potato Head. Remember when leftists and liberals, they fought bitterly against censorship and book banning and called Christians the book banners because they didn't agree with obscenity. Now, I don't see anything quite too obscene about Mr. Potato Head, but if you're a leftist liberal, you think Mr. Potato Head ought to be banned, along with Mark Twain, Gone with the Wind, and on and on. So who are the book banners today? Leftist liberals also restrict movement of everyday citizens, and they're shutting down dissent and cheering about it. Did you ever think you'd see, if you were around in the 60s, and I was a little before coming of age in the 60s, leftist liberals cheering about shutting down dissent while they call Putin and others dictators because they shut down dissent. Huh? Did you ever think you'd hear when leftist liberals suddenly love big corporations like Walmart and they want to shut down mom and pop shops because their betters told them to? Did you ever see that leftists believe in body integrity unless the government is demanding that you take a shot that they say is good for you and enriches giant big pharma whom you used to hate? I could go on forever. We're living in a pathological time in which everything has been turned on its head. And the lesson of Purim is this isn't the first time this happened. Purim is the story of living in a time in which you really can't believe your eyes and you certainly can't believe what you're being told. And you certainly can't say we're doomed because just in a heartbeat, things can turn around on a dime. And that's the story of Purim. And God's hand is everywhere, but God is never mentioned. Now, all we can hope, all I can hope, let's hope and pray that we're living in the Purim in our time and things get turned around, be put right side up, that bad guys are held accountable for their behavior, that people are able to stand up and disagree with their government because anything less would be communism, Marxism, whatever ism you'd like to apply to it. And that's why it's been really valuable to me to study about Purim as an adult instead of going to a cheap Purim carnival where you throw a ping pong ball into a sea of goldfish bowls, and if it lands in one, you get the goldfish. And, of course, the goldfish dies in about 24 hours. And I enjoyed it. I mean, we eat these cute little cookies called Hamantaschen, which is in the shape of a three-cornered hat. Oddly enough, that's not colonial times, although three-cornered hats were colonial as well. But it is to commemorate Purim. I'll have to ask our teacher here who's coming on in the second segment about the three-cornered hat if I get time. I don't know. But they're always triangular in shape, and they have little jam. They're like butter cookies, only they're rather large butter cookies. And we love to give gifts on Purim. We give charity to the poor, and we love to send baskets of fruit and nuts and cookies. Sort of sounds like the precursor of the Easter basket, doesn't it? There are so many interesting things. I'm not so much an able to be a student of history in order to know, but I'll tell you what, the stunning amount of upside downedness that we are seeing. Did you ever think that you'd live to see the day when America appears to be, continues to show its cards as more pro-communist than possibly even Russia? When Russia, the old Soviet Union, was the epitome of communism, the left apologized for them and said, well, it's not that bad. And they went after Americans. I mean, the McCarthy era was very, very painful for many because they so overtly went after people for dissenting opinions. Well, what do you think's happening today? I tried to watch this film about being the Ricardos, and I had no idea what it was because I had just seen the documentary, which is wonderful, by the way. I loved it. I was never an enormous fan of Lucille Ball. Wasn't my particular cup of tea. But the historical significance of someone like Lucille Ball is interesting. Well, I come to find out that the movie with Nicole Kidman playing Lucille Ball is all about when Lucille Ball was called a communist. And Hoover, which was no great saint, my God, he wasn't, Well, he had long since cleared her. She signed a communist card because her grandfather, I guess, was communist. But Hollywood loves that, you know, they were a victim during the McCarthy era, but now they are every bit as McCarthyist to conservatives, Trump voters, everyone else, as is the left. So I don't know if it's payback for them or what they're doing, but they are as twisted and upside down as could be. And my slogan for a long time now has been, every day is Purim. May God turn our country right side up again. That's my prayer. Hopefully God is doing just that, however you conceive him to be, because we're a religiously pluralistic country, and I love it. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have our first guest. Oh, so much to talk about. We're on Spouting Off. Stay tuned. You're on WSMN 1590 AM. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Spouting Off with Karen Cataline.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, inventor of MyPillow. Thanks to your support, you've helped make MyPillow become one of the fastest growing companies in America. Over the last 12 years, you've helped MyPillow create thousands of jobs right here in the USA. Every MyPillow is made with passion here in my home state of Minnesota to ensure you get the best sleep of your life.
One of the things that I really like about MyPillow is the support. It gives my neck a little hug.
I've never slept better in my life. What's better than a great night's sleep?
Call or go online to take advantage of my best offer ever. For a limited time, when you use your promo code, you can get premium MyPillows regularly $69.98, now only $29.98. That's right, only $29.98. That's the lowest price ever. I tried every pillow, from expensive down pillows that just went flat to fiber-fill pillows that rebound every time you move your head. I even tried those memory foam pillows, and the curve did not match my neck, and it probably won't match yours. That's why I invented MyPillow. My patented fill adjusts to your exact individual needs and helps keep your neck supported and aligned.
When I got MyPillow, I'm asleep almost immediately. I stay asleep at night, and I wake up more well-rested in the morning.
MyPillow has a 10-year warranty. It's machine washable and dryable, and I back them with my 60-day money-back guarantee. Call or go online now to take advantage of my best offer ever. Use the promo code to get queen-size premium MyPillows regularly $69.98 for only $29.98. Get king-size MyPillows for just $5 more. It's the lowest price ever. This is a limited-time offer and not available in stores. Don't delay. Order now. With our 60-day money-back guarantee, you have nothing to lose.
Sleep well, America!
For the best night's sleep in the whole wide world, visit MyPillow.com.
And now, more Spouting Off with Karen Cataline.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to Spouting Off Thursday. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Happy Purim. Whether you're Jewish or Christian, I don't care what you are, Muslim, I don't care. If you want to, if you care to, read the Book of Esther. In our second segment, we're going to have somebody that I am studying with to give us a little more insight for both, for everyone, not just Jews, about Purim. Also, a little note about the MyPillow spot that you heard right before. If you'd like to order, the best thing to do is call 1-800-867-0416. That's a special number for us, and or you can go to MyPillow.com, but use the promo code RAM, R-A-M, and that way Right America Media will get credit for that. I am just delighted to have with us the co-founder of a group called Are You Ready? Are Ya Sitting Down? Every Black Life Matters. Oh, no, that must be racist. I know it is. You can't say every Black Life Matters. You can't say every life matters. You have to say what we tell you to. Well, guess what? This man does not. His name is Neil Mammon, and he's a speaker at conferences all around the country. He debated Eric Rothschild of the ACLU. Love to hear about that. And and he does radio in KKLA. He is the president of the Values Advocacy Council and has spoken for the family. Check out noblindfaith.com. And thank you, Neil Mammon, for joining us here on Spouting Off on WSMN.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Yeah, so Neil, tell us how you came up with this organization and tell us all about what it stands for.
Well, I have to admit, I did not come up with the idea. The most beautiful woman in the world did, my wife.
Uh-huh.
You know, aww, behind every good idea, there's a woman, right?
So, not so always. My wife would. I like men too, but, you know, that's very nice anyway. Go ahead.
So we were talking about, my wife was looking through Facebook and noticed some of our dear Christian friends were out protesting with BLM, with their young kids. And my wife turned to me and says, they have no idea that BLM is not only Marxist, but they teach critical race theory. And, you know, they're against the family. They're against, they're pro-choice, everything that this, you know, our friends would not stand for. But yet, she said, they want to show people that they're not racist, right? They want to right. stand for this cause, right? And they want their kids to stand for this cause. So she turned to me and she says, you know, there needs to be an alternative, a Christian alternative. And then she said, you know, you need to call Kevin and tell him to do this. So Kevin McGarry is my co-founder, and he is the current president of the Frederick Douglass Foundation in California. That's a larger black organization.
Oh, now that is something we want to talk about, Frederick Douglass. Keep some time for that, because a lot of Americans don't know about Frederick Douglass. But go right
there
ahead.
There is a movie coming out. There is a movie coming out shortly, by the way.
Oh, so that's great.
Done
okay,
by
go
the right
ahead.
People. So I called up Kevin and I said, Kevin, you know, you and the Frederick Douglass need to start this thing that is the alternative to BLM. And, you know, that way people can use your organization to show that they're not a racist and they stand with blacks. And he said, great idea. Called the head office and they said, look, Kevin, we're way too busy getting out the word. It was the election season, getting out the black vote for the Republicans, because Frederick Douglass was a Republican, right? So he says, you and Neil should start it. So Kevin calls me back up and he says, Dean Nelson, Bishop D.L. Nelson says, you and I have to start it. So I guess we're doing it. You know, it's the old, you go to the pastor says, we need a parking ministry.
Yeah, yeah.
And the pastor says, yep, you're hired. Go for it. You know, you're the
you
one.
You know what, Neil? I got to ask you a question about something you said, because I'll forget otherwise. Why should anybody have to show we're not racists? Aren't we being put on the defensive? We're already being accused of it because of the color of our skin. I don't know what color your skin is. I don't even care. But if you're a racist because you're the color of your skin, because of the color of your skin, or because you're an American, or because you voted for Trump, isn't that racist? Why shouldn't we be fighting on that level?
Absolutely. But the problem is the culture has devolved to where that is the standard. And unless
we
start fighting and pushing back.
Yeah, but we can't allow it to be the standard. You know,
right, exactly.
I don't want anybody out there starting a group just so that they can show people they're not racist. I mean, oh my God, I'm sorry. It just struck me so strange.
No, you're absolutely correct. But the reality is that's what's happening, because you have people going into restaurants and yelling and berating at people, saying, say Black Lives Matter. We have radio show, TV people and reporters trying to pressurize Republicans to say Black Lives Matter.
Now, there's an answer for that. Don't make me say anything I don't want to. It's kind of like saying you're going to swear allegiance to Satan. Just do it or I'll punch you. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. But there is an alternative. And what we call it the Aikido tactic. Now, the Aikido is a martial art where you actually use the enemy's force and against him, right? Force and direction.
Ooh, tell us about
him.
That. Yeah.
So if somebody strikes you or swings at you, rather than blocking their move, which takes energy, and then you need to be bigger than him to stop that block, what you do is you sidestep it and you push that block away from you. So you actually, and the idea behind Aikido is that you don't hurt yourself. And in many cases, you don't need to hurt the assailant. You just take them down. And so the idea here is, let's do that. Let's do the Aikido move. Let's take them down using their own words. And so this is something that we are focused on. And let me finish the story real quick, and I'll come back to the Aikido move because it'll explain, it'll sort of put everything in context. So he calls me up. He says, I guess we're going to do it. We're going to have to do it. And I said, well, Kevin, I think you forget something. And he says, what's that? I said, Kevin, I'm not black. You see,
you're not allowed.
He said, no. You are African American. You see, I was born in Africa. I was born in Ghana, and I grew up in Sudan and Ethiopia and Jamaica, right? So I'm African by birth. I'm ethnically Indian. My parents are Indian, right? So I'm ethnically Indian, but I'm African by birth, African by culture, grew up there. That was my whole upbringing. And so Kevin said, see, you're more African American than I am. Because Kevin is black, but he's never been to Africa. He says, I've never been to Africa. So I dub you African American. So
sounds like kind of African American our vice president is. She's not African American at all.
She's not African.
No, you're more African.
She's Indian. Like, I'm actually, it's kind of funny.
Remember when we fought against this kind of categorization of people?
Exactly.
And
that's what we're trying to do. Yes. We're trying to bring it back to that, right? So Martin Luther said it's about the content of the character, not the color of your skin. So Martin Luther, Frederick Douglass, all these guys are actually very in line with what we're teaching. Coming back to it, so what do we do? So we go up to, and this has been very successful with BLMers. Now, I'm not talking about the hardcore BLM leadership who, you know, want to make the billions of dollars.
They just got arrested, by the way.
Yeah.
Some of them just got arrested.
Who have the mansions and all that, right? I'm not talking about them. Nor am I talking about the Antifa paid people who come out to do violence. I'm talking about those college students and then the people, you know, the Christians or the people who are just like, look, I'm not a racist and I want to support them. So the first thing we notice is there is something called black plight. Blacks make the least amount of money in America. Their medium income is the lowest. But it's not blacks who make the lowest. It's African Americans who make the lowest. Turns out that Nigerians and Ghanaians, who are just as black as African Americans, maybe even more darker skin, actually make far more than most white Americans. Their medium income of Nigerians and Ghanaians are far higher. In fact, the running joke in Nigerians is, oh, I'm so sorry, your son only has a master's degree. You know, because everybody's expected to have a PhD if you're Nigerian or Ghanaian, right?
And they're being held back, though. In America, I mean, they're being held back, right?
Exactly. That's why they're making so much money. But the highest income earners in America are the Indians, the people of Indian ancestry.
Definitely.
You know, they make the highest amount of money, and they're not white either.
And
in fact, the whites don't show up till after the Taiwanese. The European Americans don't show up till after the Nigerians, right? So this is the kind of funny thing. So it's got nothing to do with the color of your skin. It's got to do with something else. And so we were looking at that. And so then this is how the conversation goes when we talk to BLMers or, you know, the casual BLMers or the college students or the liberals. We say, look, do black lives really matter to you? And of course they say yes. And we say, well, look, does every single black life matter to you? And of course they're going to have to say yes. And we'll say, well, you know, did you know that because of the socialistic welfare policies in the 1970s, the black fatherless rate was about 22%. But then in the 1970s, LBJ and the Democrat Party passed all these welfare laws. And that told the welfare recipients that if there was a father in the home, they got less money. So between the 1970s and today, fatherlessness went from 22% to 74% in many cases. And in some cities, it's more like 80 to 90%, like Chicago. Right. We says, do those fatherless kids, black lives matter to you? Now, of course, they're going to have to say yes. We said, well, don't you think we should do something about changing those policies? They're going to say yes. So then we say, well, okay, let me ask you a couple of other questions. The next question is, did you know that because of that fatherlessness, young men are now joining gangs and they're getting involved in crime and all that? In fact, the crime rate is so high that many people are afraid of young black men because of the crime rate amongst black communities. And he said, did you know that this is because of the fatherlessness? And as a result of that fatherlessness, now those gangs and violences and drugs are getting into the schools. And so black community public schools have a literacy rate of 17%. Did you know that the height of racism in the 1930s, the black literacy rate was 70%? So the public schools are failing them. In fact, 68% of black parents want a school voucher so they can take their kids out of that bad failing public school and send them to somewhere where there is no violence, where the private schools are actually, or the church schools are actually doing something. And every time they've had the vouchers, they've done really well. But guess who won't allow us to have vouchers? It's the Democrat Party and the unions. Don't those school children, Black Lives Matter to you? And what are they going to say? Well, yes, of course they have to say yes. And we've tried this and it works. And we say, let me ask you a couple more questions. And we say, look, you know, did you know that? Did you know that there are 44 million African Americans today? But there would be 64 million African Americans. But because 20 million African Americans were killed before they could even be born in the womb. Now, that's 30% of all African Americans. I mean, there would be 50% more African Americans than there are. That means that's a genocide of the Black African Americans. Do you care about those unborn Black lives? What are they going to say? I mean, this is a genocide.
Yeah, and those Christians, those mean old Christians are standing up for the lives of Black babies. And what do they get for their trouble? They're called racists.
They're called racists. Right. And and I say, look, I don't care if you're pro-choice or pro-life. I do care that you're pro-life, but I am pro-life. I say, you know, in fact, our logo has the baby's feet in it for Every Black Life Matters. But I say, it doesn't matter where you, Mr. BLMer, stand on this issue, but you have to admit that killing 30% of a race is genocide. And they have to say yes. And I say, well,
how could it not be, you know? How could it not
and
be?
I say,
I don't know.
I say, one last thing. Do you know that this minimum wage was created by the KKK? And they're like, what? I said, well, you see, back in the 1930s, at the height of racism, Black men would go to a racist business owner and say, I will work for half the price of a white man. And they were working and they were getting all those skills. In fact, they were doing so well that the money was going back in the Black community and staying in the Black community. They had dentists and lawyers. In fact, six of the airplanes in Tulsa, Oklahoma were owned by Black people, by Black families. There were more Black millionaires in Tulsa, Oklahoma amongst the Blacks than there were in the rest of Tulsa, right? Per square mile. But then what happened is the white KKK and the Democrats said, this is not right. And they said, we've got to make a minimum wage. And the minimum wage just coincidentally happened to be the minimum wage of a white person. And so guess what? Now you're a racist business owner and a Black person comes to you and says, before I could make money off you, now I can't make money for you. I'm not going to hire you. And then, of course, they did the Juneteenth and they burned down Tulsa, Oklahoma, and they burned down a lot of communities and all that. You just know that the minimum wage is what's limiting people, because now these kids are coming out of college with a literacy rate of 17%. Oh. Nobody's going to give them a job at $15 an hour. And so Thomas Sowell, a Black economist, says, the minimum wage effectively for Black youth is zero because you won't let them get a job. Don't you think we should allow Black kids to learn and grow into their positions? And the minimum wage and the free market principles are what's going to allow them to get there. Do those unemployed Black kids matter to you? And then, of course, they're going to have to say yes, and they do.
Well, you hope that they do.
Really,
Neil, if I didn't know better, oh, gosh, we only have 60 seconds. Doggone it. Beautifully said. If I didn't know better, I would think that all the left that have been virtue signaling about how much they care about minorities have actually been harming minorities. You think that's possible?
They have. They have, yes. Our website, by the way, is everyblm.com, everyblm.com. And we talk about all these.
BLM. Go ahead. Say that again.
Doc. Yeah. Every BLM, and we can. There's actually a sheet. If you go to resources, you can download exactly what I just said and print it out and carry it with you and talk to people about this.
Can they also follow you on any kind of social media, whatever?
Yeah. We're on Facebook, and we'll find all that on our website, everyblm.com. Or just look
Neil
up
Mammon.
Every Black Lives Matter.
Oh, so important. What a great organization. We support you. I hope others will, too. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have my teacher and talk about Purim. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Spouting Off with Karen Cataline.
Are you tired of the same old snacks? Looking for something a little healthier than that bag of chips or candy bar? Even your average bag of trail mix these days is little more than peanuts, raisins, and candy-coated chocolate. Not very healthy, is it? Allow me to introduce you to White Mountain Munchies. Made from 100% all-natural ingredients, White Mountain Munchies combines unique flavors with nutritional value that will tingle your taste buds and strengthen and sustain your overall health and wellness. Eating good never tasted so good. From Maggie's Maple Madness to Hannah's Heavenly Harvest, Grayson's Getaway Goodies, and our limited edition Christmas blend, Jacoby's Jolly Jumble, White Mountain Munchies offers nutritious and delicious snacks that the whole family is sure to love. Pick yours up now through our easy-to-use online store at whitemountainmunchies.com. White Mountain Munchies, non-GMO when you're on the go.
And now, more Spouting Off with Karen Cataline.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to this very special day on Thursday, March 17th. People are out. They're in a festive mood. And I am in an extra special festive mood, not only because, well, it's St. Patty's Day, it's also Purim. And in honor of that, I told you at the beginning, teased you just a little, that I usually get to have at least one, if not several, teaching sessions with my next guest. And she called, there's a word in Yiddish called beshert, which means meant to be. So maybe it's meant to be because we had an opening totally unexpected today and she was available. And I thought, well, let's just partake of her knowledge and this interesting day in which St. Patrick's Day and Purim all fall on the same day today, March 17th. Her name is Ita Kay, and she is a teacher with Beis Chana International, and she's right here. Hi, Itty. How are you?
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, and happy Purim to you.
Happy Purim. You know, I love the little intro you gave where you said, happen to call, because that's actually the whole theme of Purim that people may not know about.
Tell us about that. That's a good place to start. Things happen, yeah. And not a lot of coincidences, but they seem like it, right?
Correct, exactly. So you may, if you live close to a Jewish community and or you go online and you research Purim, you may get images of people walking around in masks. And the reason why we do that is because what we're celebrating is miracles wearing masks, meaning hidden miracles. Uh-huh. So when things look like they happen to happen, we have to keep in mind the coordinator that's hidden right behind, you know, God who's actually making things happen for a very specific purpose to lead us to where we need to be in order to fulfill our mission here in this world, to do a kindness for someone, you know, to save someone's day or to make someone's day. So that would be the theme of Purim, like miracles wearing masks, hidden miracles.
Yeah, and masks wouldn't be anything anybody could relate to these days, that's for sure.
Oh, I mean eye masks. That's very funny. Masks take on a whole new meaning now, right?
Yeah, people being masked, people being unmasked.
Right.
Oh,
right.
It's so relevant in so many ways.
So I meant like the beautiful masks with feathers coming out of them, you know, that you wear over your eyes to cover your face to disguise yourself. Miracles in disguise.
Yes. And so you told me earlier that there are four things that you wanted to talk about that have to do with Purim that a lot of people could learn because I love learning with you. So tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. On Purim, we have four mitzvot. A mitzvah is an obligation from God to his people. This is something I'd like you to do, right? That's a mitzvah. People are familiar with the word mitzvah. Sometimes they're just familiar with bar mitzvah, which means when a young man or a bat mitzvah, when a young woman become obligated in mitzvah. So a mitzvah means a commandment. On Purim, we have four mitzvahs, four obligations. And this in itself is already a beautiful message for anyone out there raising children or who's a teacher or in a position of influence where when there's a day of celebration, it's a day of obligation. And so we're going to talk about what our obligations are. What are the four things that we have to make sure we're doing on Purim while we're celebrating?
Mm-hmm.
I'll list them and then I'll explain them. So one is reading the Megillah, which means reading the story of Purim, remembering the past, remembering why we're celebrating, right? We're not just eating and drinking and having fun. There's a reason. So we have to remember the reason. That's number one. That's the reading the Megillah. Mm-hmm. The second mitzvah, and I'm sorry to say the second one because they're in no particular order, right? So another one of the four mitzvahs is matanot le'evyanim, which means gifts to the poor. Mm-hmm. We have to help those who don't have enough to celebrate. So before I sit down and eat with my family, I go out to the streets and I make sure to give money to those who may not have enough money to celebrate on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Another, a third of the mitzvahs is mishloach manot, which means sending out portions, sending out gift baskets of food. And that's not necessarily just to someone who needs it. We could send a beautiful food basket to our next door neighbor or our coworker or someone who lives across town. And while we try to take it as a moment of remembering someone who may be lonely, who doesn't have, you know, that little touch point, and we try to be really intentional about including those who may not have friends or neighbors next to them thinking about them, mm-hmm. the actual theme of the food baskets is not charity, but it's unity. It's like, I trust your food and I'll eat from you. And I'm thinking, you know, and I give what I have, et cetera. So it's more about unity. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth of the four mitzvahs of Purim is mishte, which means to sit down and have a feast. We sit, we break bread together, we eat, we drink, and we celebrate with a meal that brings the family together, the community together. Those are the four mitzvahs of Purim.
Well, Itza, I do a little regular guest appearance on a show, wonderful show, Vic Porcelli in St. Louis. And there's a couple of stock jokes that I tell. And one of them is most Jewish holidays. I don't know how you'll take this. Most Jewish holidays are they tried to kill us. They didn't. Let's eat.
That's very funny. Exactly. Or they succeeded.
Because
so
many.
Passed, right?
Yeah, so many stories yeah. are that. And that said, leads me to this question, which I have always, ever since I started to appreciate Purim as an adult, and now it's like one of my favorite Jewish holidays all year long, is the whole idea that things are upside down. And as you know, since I do a lot of political commentary, we're living in times that certainly fit that description. People are divided. There's a lot of things coming out that don't seem believable. As I've given a couple of examples, criminals are now victims and law-abiding citizens are criminals, et cetera, et cetera. Things seem upside down. Go back in time as to how it was that in Purim, it is exemplary. It illustrates that question, that everything is just not quite what it appears to be in the story of Purim.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's very interesting, especially when we look at one of the most famous kind of, you know, superwomen in the Purim story. When we look at Esther's story, things mm-hmm. seemed very upside down and possibly uncomfortable, you know, to say the least, for Queen Esther. You think about a woman who's raised by her uncle Mordechai, who's the head of the Sanhedrin, the head of the Jewish courts. So she's raised for kindness and she's raised with Jewish tradition. And suddenly she gets taken to what is the most, seems to be such a superficial, what is this, a beauty contest? You know, and that's what it was. It's just, it's superficial and it's horrible. And it's the king of Persia. I mean, that's not really a place for a Jewish young woman to be or, you know, like today, if you think about it as, you know, let's say any country in the world that you may compare to the, you know, powerful empire, just taking a Jewish woman off the streets and hiding her, locking her up in their palace. So it definitely seemed, it must have seemed very confusing, frightening. What am I, what is this going to lead to? How am I going to stay true to God, stay true to my traditions, stay true to my upbringing in this unfamiliar environment? And so I guess, you know, maybe you're, maybe what you want to ask is, well, how did she stay positive? Like, how did she,
How did she keep her cool?
Right, how did she keep her head?
See, you don't need me. I don't need to interview you. I let, just let you run with it. It's an excellent
question. Is that what it is? Is that what we should explain? Yeah. So, exactly. So it's not a, coincidence that she was raised by Mordechai, who always had this strong faith in God. It's what she needed to prepare her to go into the palace, because what happens is that every turn, she has to ask, why am I here? And not just, why am I here because, oh, some king got drunk and decided to kill his wife and then have a beauty pageant and bring me here, but why am I truly here? Like, why does the King of Kings want me to be here? Why does the creator want me to be? That hidden hand behind all the scenery, the director, like, why does he want me to be here? And so for many years, she didn't really know. She just, this is a beautiful, the Midrashim tell us she had seven different maidservants, each for a different day of the week, so that she could keep track of when is Shabbat and celebrate it properly. You know, so she did whatever she can to maintain her Jewish identity, or not identity, she was hiding her identity, but keep her ways. And then ultimately, when Haman decreed this plot against the Jews, that's when Mordechai, her uncle and also her rabbi, was able to tell her, perhaps it was for this moment that you were brought to the palace, to the kingdom. And that's when she knew, oh, that's why I'm here. This is why I'm here. So she never lost her faith, because she knew there was a reason, but she didn't know for quite a while what the reason may be. It took years for of her living in the palace before the plot even occurred.
Just to accentuate that, and of course, this is a commentary interpretation. Many people are asking that today. I won't ask you to make any political connections, because that's not what you do. But for our listeners, we have many, many people of all faiths that are asking, why is this happening now? There's so much unrest, so much confusion, propaganda and what have you. And you're saying one of the lessons of Purim is that when the time is right, we learn why we are where we are. And that, as you say, I don't always, sometimes I have trouble understanding this, but as you say, God's in control. You just may not know why all these things are happening. That's what you teach.
The important thing to know is why he hides. He's in control, but he hides because he wants us to step up and partner with him. Right? That's why God wears a mask and hides. He wants us to partner with him. But, you know, in answer to your other question that you asked,
yes,
what are we supposed to do? I think Queen Esther also gives us the answer to that. We have to act on two levels. Before she went to the king and acted on a political level, she told Mordechai, you have to gather all the Jews and you need to fast and you need to pray to God. You need to reconnect to God, because God's the one who's going to be ensuring our success. So the decree began when the Jewish people forgot God and kind of attended, you know, the Persian parties and tried to they lost their way. And the salvation began when Esther reminded them to return to their ways. You gather all the Jews, so unity, fast, that means repent, right? Apologize, reconnect with God, and pray. Pray for a good outcome, reconnect. And only then did she go and approach the king. So we do have to act on both of these levels. One is remember to do what we need to do regarding whatever God commands us. You know, there are seven laws of Noah that are obligations for every one of the billions of people who share this earth, this beautiful earth with us. The obligations not to murder, the obligations not to steal, the obligations to remember one God, the obligations to, you know, not to hurt animals. There are seven obligations that all of us have to adhere to. So we need to connect with God and fulfill those obligations. And on the second level, we need to, wherever we find ourselves, Esther found herself in her palace, so she had to go ahead and speak to the king. You find yourself in talk radio, so you have to go ahead and influence whoever and share ideas and invite people into conversations that are important, right? So we have our obligations to God and our obligations to fulfill politically or in natural ways. You know, someone's a teacher, someone's a doctor, someone is a mother. Each person, wherever they are, has to also fulfill their specific, not just their general mission of, you know, the laws of the mitzvot, but also their specific mission, responding to where they are and what the needs are where they are and where they can influence to the good anyone who they can influence.
Now you can see why Itti Kay is fulfilling her mission, which is to educate Jews and Jewish women. Articulate, clear, and really fun to study with, too.
Thank you Itti, so much, Karen.
Yeah, Itti, tell everyone a little more about Beis Chana International, what it does, and who it serves primarily, would you?
Absolutely, and thank you so much, because this is, you know, the greatest thing that we can do is when we know more, we can do more. So what we do at Beis Chana Women International is we unite Jewish women and Jewish girls at different stages of their lives. We have a teen camp in the summers. We have a college program in the winters. We have programs for single Jewish mothers, for women 55 plus, and for women of all ages and stages. And you could find us at baischana.org. It's BAISCHANA.org, Beis Chana Women International. And what our idea is, when you strengthen the individual, that's the only and the clearest and the most powerful way to strengthen a family, which then strengthens community, which then strengthens and unites all of us in the worldwide community. So we start at individual level, you know, strengthening young women, old women, women who have lived many years, lived few years, with just knowledge about who we are.
I've got to say, and I have enough time to say it, so I'm going to say it. You and I, when we have our very, very spirited discussions about everything, I mean, dissent is, we're like, I love being like a yeshiva bacher, like a yeshiva student asking questions and saying, oh, this doesn't even make any sense. And Itti never shies away from a question, but even more, sometimes there are ideas that don't quite jive with my pro-liberty stance, but the one that you just said jives 100%. And that is the joy of the accountability and the individual relationship with God. There is no argument there at all. And how great that is that you can, and that's just such a truism, that you can strengthen communities and people of all faiths and different faiths when you strengthen the individual and
that's
you
right.
Let them know they have free will and they're accountable for their choices. How cool is that?
That's right. And that's one of our most exciting things that we do at Beis Chana is we argue and we debate and we ask questions and nothing's off the table. We talk about relationships and purpose and how do we know?
Pizza.
How do we know there's free will? How do we know what's true? Yes.
Itti,
so,
we
thank
have
you.
To go.
Happy
I gotta
Purim.
Wrap up the show. Happy Purim. Thank you for your time for coming on the air with me on this auspiciously wonderful day of Purim and of St. Patrick's Day. Take care. Well, that about does it for us here on this day. And it's always great to elevate your day, however you do it. Be sure to tune in tomorrow. I'll have a new guest tomorrow on Spouting Off. Just go to KarenCataline.com. Thanks to everyone at WSMN, and I'll see you next week, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, when there will be so much more to spout off about here on Spouting Off. WS